The next case is 97-867, Columbus Bar Association versus Philip Zouder.
Contract with his staff, it's the contract with him, and he wants to alter to his client's detriment for stuff he's didn't even properly record or properly allocate, and he's just doing a general formula now to make up for his own deficiency. That troubles me.
Doc, he acknowledges that he should have kept better records of that, but the situation from his point of view then, remember we're looking at this in retrospect, from his point of view, it was still an uncertain situation. His clients did not know what the financial impact of what he was going, what he was proposing was going to be. And there was an offer on the table. He had nothing concrete to talk about. The clients that he originally started representing in cases as individuals, had turned into a bankruptcy matter. There was a trust fund. They didn't understand. It's very difficult to explain it to his clients under those circumstances.
So he had a staff do it instead?
Pardon?
He said he had a staff do it because it was difficult to explain?
No. He did not have an adequate staff to handle the bookkeeping and the accounting. He admits that. He knows that he messed up in the way he kept track of this. There's something. But there is no evidence in the record that he contacted these clients, preyed upon them, took advantage of them. There's simply no testimony of what the board, and because the board did, we think the relator have tried to do, is turn it into a proposition of law that this is the way it has to be handled.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mr. Altman. I am interested in your disagreement with the board's recommendation as to how the sanction will be imposed. And one of the arguments you make is that the clients here, Mr. Zauder's clients, are going to be sort of dragged into the gristmill of the disciplinary system. Can you tell me, in view of paragraph 4 in the plan or the recommended sanction, which seems to protect at least the names of the clients. What do you mean by your statement about
the problem we have had all along in this case is that the relator's insistence, not unreasonably given the initial contract, that this is a matter not involving a complaint by two clients who have waived confidentiality, but 172 of them have not. In order to establish what he did for these clients and to show these expenses, what they were and why they were necessary, he is going to have to show what his medical staff did, $82,000 worth of medical records. Most of these expenses have to do with medical records, things that simply should not become public records. There's no adequate way for the board to keep this from becoming a public record. That is one of the reasons we tried to structure this thing so that if we get to the court to have you look at it.
Well, couldn't he, I don't get too much detail here, but couldn't he submit copies of statements from doctors or hospitals for services rendered or whatever without revealing certainly who the patient was, the client is, and the nature of the services? Is that not...
Right. For some, for some of them is what he has in the file is going to be their medical records. And so it's just a problem. He realizes that this is his responsibility, that he should have had better records. But his problem is, in order to prove his case, he's going to have to reveal information that just shouldn't be revealed. Our factual disagreements with the relator are very few. Our disagreements with the board's findings and recommendations, as you know, from brief, are very substantial. We frankly think that the relator is more informed and aware of problems in this case than the board is. That's not entirely the board's fault, because what was important at the hearing were stipulations and other sketchy evidence. And as we say, we were not able, nor did we want to get into what was necessary to defend this case, to show confidential information that we don't think ought to be public. The brief of the relator overstates in many cases what our position is. We do not, for example, believe that attorney client contracts are or should be matters of place and fair. What we want to point out to the court, though, is that this is a considerable problem for the legal profession. It was thoroughly debated when the American Bar Association was trying to develop model rules. They rejected the idea of having contracts and writing to the client, negotiated contracts and writing. Attorneys and their clients need to have the flexibility to renegotiate contracts as it goes along. This, of course, means that there has to be regulation and oversight. That's what this process is. Mr. Zauber realizes that it's perfectly reasonable for the Columbus Bar Association to inquire into this. And he doesn't disagree with most of their arguments as abstract statements of law. But the problem is, he had a problem he had to deal with then. He did what he thought was reasonable at the time. In retrospect, it's obvious that his records are woefully inadequate. And moreover, will create a problem for his clients and his tribes to introduce them. And given that situation, he has preferred to handle it the way he has proposed, yes, return all those expenses.
And who knows whether, since this matter all came up because one of his clients complained about it, as I understand it, who's to know whether he's returned all the money he should have returned, and that the clients are going to know they have any any claim to it?
There's a specific time period in which all these settlements took place. As soon as the Columbus Bar said, don't do it, he said, I won't do it. He has settlement sheets for all of those, copies for all of those can be made available. And Columbus Bar has some of them, not all of them. But they will show the entire amount of the expenses that were charged. We have reviewed those. He has deposited more in that account than were charged. And he does have addresses. We think the matter can be handled very expeditiously when the basis of our agreement.
Did he ever have any problem keeping records before?
I can't say for sure. I don't. From what I saw, I don't imagine he was ever in a
I thought Justice Stein might be asking about his prior public reprimand in multi-district litigation.
That was an antitrust violation.
But this is the other aspect of this that is, I guess, noteworthy, is that we get the, we're told that the respondent here regularly handles these sort of class action cases, and therefore would be, or ought to have been, more adept at his record keeping.
I think he was later more adept, but he learned the hard way.
This is
his and he did some aggressive implant litigation later. He certainly learned his lesson from what the Dalcom Shield cases. I see my time is almost up, so I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Altman. Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Justice C. Court. The relator finds itself in a somewhat conflicted position today, in that on the one hand, it agrees with respondent that the remedy originally proposed by way of stipulation in 1994 was a sensible and we believe appropriate way of handling this disciplinary matter. We believe then and we believe now that the agreement would achieve the important objectives of the disciplinary process, protection of clients, integrity of the profession, and fairness. On the other hand, we do not share the respondent's view to the board by making other recommendations beyond those suggested. Somehow exceeded his authority or went beyond the record of the case in such ways as to deny the respondent fair process. We have summarized our position in terms of four propositions which parallel those presented by the respondent. The first proposition concerns the oral modification of a written fee agreement for the benefit of the lawyer. The second involves propriety towards partial rejection of the stipulations. The third has to do with the constitutional arguments which the respondent has made. And finally, Proposition 4 argues that the initial resolution proposed by the parties was made fairly. With the court's permission, I'll deal with the first two of these, and Mr. Hunter will deal with the last. The first proposition has to do, of course, with the matter itself. The respondent has told this court in his brief and to some extent today that he was in taking this series of cases going off into uncharted waters, which he found, and I quote, the usual navigational procedures no longer applicable. That for lack of guidance, he should not be held culpable for this court. I may not be a sailor, but I do know a few. And I believe that one of the first rules of navigation is that if you want to find out where you are and where you are going, keep accurate records of where you've been. I think it's also intuitively obvious that if you are adrift, but you have the means for reaching out and getting some guidance from some source, that you do that sooner rather than later. The respondent did not take those steps. Rather, he chose to sail off blithely, that is only by his own lines, and make it up as he went along. Unfortunately, however, he didn't give any guidance to his clients and tell them warning clients to tell them what he was doing and why he was doing it. Moreover, not to keep records which ordinarily prudent attorneys keep as a matter of course. Now he asks the court for sympathy for his wife. Having made an original agreement with his clients in the form of the standard form fee contract, which by the way, Justice Stratton's case question is to be found at Exhibit A of the original complaint. And I have it here if you do want to hear my explanation. In any event, having entered into.
Yeah, what is the list of expenses?
Okay. Under cost and expense.
expenses in this paragraph. I understand the rate that out-of-pocket costs incurred or advanced by Philip Zouter and Associates in the course of investigations or handling of any litigation or appeal on behalf, including but not limited to court costs, long-distance telephone charges, court costs, this will be a second time, document duplication costs, brief printing costs, postage, court reporter fees, medical report expenses, witness fees, costs of obtaining evidence, necessary disbursements, reasonable travel expenses incurred by Philip Zouter and Associates in advancing my cause must be borne by me. And then there is reference in another section about compensation for medical experts.
Mr. Campbell, I must have missed it someplace, but the stipulations to which everyone refers, they're set out only paraphrased. I haven't found them. Maybe they're in the record. But what the stipulation was, it was a recommendation there be a public reprimand and that Mr. Zouter repay the clients who are entitled to a refund, I guess, of their cost. What are the details? I mean, who monitors it? Does the bar monitor it?
Well, certainly to the extent that he would have to report back to us that he's accomplished what he has said to do. We were prepared and are prepared to accept his counsel's assertion that, in fact, what he said he would do has been done. And that was really the basis of the stipulation. One of the questions in terms of records kept, his counsel examined the individual settlements, and from those was compiled a list of the actual expenses deducted from all of these cases. We were prepared to accept counsel's word that that list collected those settlement sheets and did not feel it was necessary for us to examine each and every one.
Okay.
But having initially contracted clients for a given fee agreement, the respondent thought were in midstream that agreement was not fair to him. He was piling up these expenses that he now wishes to refer to as generic. And he came up with a method for recouping those expenses. The problem was that he didn't give his clients any notice of that until the very last minute. And then only a very cursory phone call by an employee of his. One has to wonder if the notion that the respondent has fairness to him is somewhat skewed. Attorneys in every area of practice incur expenses that might be called generic. They attend seminars, meetings, they buy computers, they purchase other capital equipment, and they do that in an effort to remain competent in order to be in a position to earn fees. And we should remember that Mr. Zouter earned generous fees in these cases. If we take his own figure, that the expenses admitted to related were only 6% of total settlements. If you calculate that out and then take a third of those settlements, you find out that he has earned about $1 million, perhaps more. It is clear that he is being well compensated, but on top of that, he tried to expense various items which most attorneys accept.
Would that be the category of expensive gathering evidence? That sounds like the practice of law to me. That was one of the items.
That would be one of them.
Items that you listed. I don't know what that means.
We do not disagree with the proposition that we may person expenses that benefit more than one client, and that you may be able, given that notice to the client, to spread those out. But you have, it seems to us, that you have a reasonable formula for saying how much this item benefited this client, not just to make it one guess. Certainly, if you're going to do it on the basis of across the board the surcharge, you want to let the clients know that in advance of what you're so. It seems to us that the board is quite correct in concluding that the respondent has violated PR 9.2.3 as he has committed himself to this stuff, and that its decision in this regard is entirely consistent with the record. The respondent has raised several issues which we believe are strong arguments. Confidentiality issue. Certainly, if the board wishes to have some sort of monitor arrangement whereby the provisions of the agreement and the provisions of the order are carried out, that can be done in a way that will not jeopardize confidentiality of compliance and to the extent may result in some revelation or confidential information to benefit this is one of those clients who are more than compensated for that. We are not arguing that the respondent ought to have our clients promised to the house, as the respondent has suggested we are, but we do believe that once a problem has been identified, the disciplinary authorities ought to have the ability to look into those problems and make sure that they are all taken care of. We do not believe, as the respondent has suggested, or ran amok by ignoring existing authority regarding overhead expenses. If you read the very opinions that have been cited in this court, you can find no objection, no support for the notion that kind of wide open view of expenses and anything that is remote from the context of the case can be done on a fairly haphazard basis as he has done. This is not just a matter of accounting, as he argues. It is a matter of direct concern to the extent that the lawyers and counties for our clients' money fails to live up to the expectations of the code.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Hunter.
And beyond the jurisdiction of the board and this court, and also goes on to argue that there is insufficient evidence that the money ordered reimbursed is actually due the former clients and is thus a denial of due process and equal protection. There's no doubt that under Article 4, Section 2 of the Ohio Constitution, that this court does have the inherent power to govern the admission to practice of law and the discipline of persons so admitted. Respondent at page 17 in its own brief admits that one of the available sanctions is probation subject to conditions. The Board of Commissioners on Grievance and Discipline has recommended that respondent serve a one-year suspension and that be suspended on certain conditions, among which are the reimbursement of expenses that respondent collected from 174 Delcon Shield cases settled under a formula that he devised. concerning evidence of the expenses, we would point out the expenses are expenses that respondent identified as collecting from his clients. The respondent in his brief at page 7 has admitted, quote, he did not set up his records and ledgers so that expenses incurred could be allocated between direct and generic expenses. There's no segregation of accounts, either of expenses incurred or money received of expenses, as his checks were not coded, unquote. Respondent admits to having to resort to Schedule C filings to extrapolate what he claims to be generic expenses in order to attempt to justify to the relator that these were justified expenses, and the board, in fact, found many of them to be overhead type of expenses and not generic. Respondent has admitted that the written agreement does not call for this type of expense deduction, and he derived the formula by, quote, picking it out of my head, unquote. Respondent further admits that he did not seek written approval of his clients for the expense deduction, and that the clients were only informed of the amount of expenses on the eve of settlement.
Mr. Hunter, let me interrupt you. We're pretty familiar, I think, with the facts. I think the question, there's a dispute between the respondent and the Board of Commissioners and Grievances, obviously, as to what the sanction should be here. If I understood Mr. Campbell correctly, the bar was willing to say, in effect, that we'll take the council's word for the expenses that are due and the fact that they have been refunded or paid back to the clients. That assumes that council, of course, would work with their client, and both council, obviously, are council that we highly respect and would expect that if their client is honest with them, we'd get an adequate result. The board, on the other hand, apparently is not satisfied with that. They think there should be what the respondents are concerned is a very expensive and somewhat difficult process that would cause production of records and so forth, so that somehow I guess there's more credibility to the end result. The bar, your statement seemed to be indicating to me that perhaps you've sided more with the board of commissioners' view that we've got a person here who, say the least, is a bad record keeper, and can we, in the way in which this arose, that he didn't voluntarily give back expenses that he thought perhaps were excessive. In fact, I think he still thinks they're not excessive. What's the best way to resolve this?
Your Honor, relators had no problem dealing with counsel for respondent in this instance. This investigation took approximately 26 months from its inception until presentation to the panel of the board. During that time, we did have records deposition. We had a deposition of Mr. Zotter. Counsel for Mr. Zotter provided a plethora of information to us. At one point, the committee sought and received authorization for the appointment of an investigator, being an accountant, to help us go through the records. We did identify such a person, and it was early on determined that these were non-auditable records, and as the court knows, the panel went through that same process, and that's why it was 36 months to the day from when it was presented. So to some extent, these records are just incapable of being audited. We feel confident that counsel for Mr. Zotter have reviewed the settlement statements and that the figures provided to us are accurate as they reflect what expenses were charged to what clients. And quite frankly, I feel comfortable, as does Mr. Campbell and the relator, in working with counsel for Mr. Zotter to
I'm one member of this court who usually likes to try to support the recommendations of the board. If they seem reasonable, usually they are. There's something that the board has seen here, some reason that the board believes that that's not enough for them. Do you know what that is? Do you have any idea what it...
Well, Your Honor, please support. This has been a difficult series of litigation for Mr. Zauder and for Dow Township clients. As the court is probably aware, litigation began in 81 and 85. There was a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing which stayed all proceedings. There was the development of a claimant board and an escrow fund to pay claims. Settlements were delayed approximately 6 years. So there is no doubt that this litigation, multi-district level litigation, was sidetracked and changed, and that expenses that were unforeseeable at the onset were charged. We feel to some extent that is the case here. We feel that the reimbursements to the clients is appropriate. We feel that a public reprimand would be appropriate, and we would certainly hope an opinion from the court setting forth as guidance to practicing attorneys just what expenses are justifiable in charging cases like this would be appropriate to send out an appropriate warning.
The board's recommendation, as you know, leaves open this time, this period of time with in which I guess others could file claims. Certainly he knows, the records would indicate who the clients were and who it would that would be entitled to refunds. What's the reason? Do you know what the reason for that?
No, I have absolutely no understanding what the reasoning for the leaving this open would be, because as was indicated by Respondent's counsel, these cases started in 81. Settlements started in 91. And when we got this in April of 92 and notified Mr. Zauder through his counsel, that method of expenses stopped.
Thank you. We've used your time.
That's what I ran. If you answered questions, and I was going to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter.
Thank you.
Mr. Altman, you saved a minute of your time for rebuttal.
Quick point. The evidence indicates that several of the clients were contacted, had this matter explained to them, and actually said, you don't want to go along with the form, and did Mr. Zauder waived it and any expenses. That they did have time to think about it, they were informed. Some of them just said, no.
Are there clients here that, do you know that it'd be nice sometimes to have the board represented here, but do you know what this period of open period is? Are there still clients who may have claims that aren't disposed of, or?
He used this formula for a limited period of time. 91 to 92, there were no settlements before that. He couldn't use it before that. He stopped using it as soon as the bar said don't, and he didn't charge expenses, then clearly attributable to a file after that. Okay. This is the only period of time that could be relevant.
What do you think the sanction should be?
As to statement that Mr. Zauder made a considerable amount of money in this, I'd like to point out that this was 1981, he was representing his clients until today. We want the court to keep in mind that the issue of generic expenses is crucially important. When you're trying to decide whether you represent particular kinds of clients that have particular kinds of problems, you have to raise, you cannot charge these expenses, say, PI clients. You're going to have to raise your costs, your hourly rates to all your other clients. That's going to make a big difference if you're going to take all these clients.
You've used your time, Mr. Altman. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal will please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. session of Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.
Thank you.